Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Mujan Sohi. Hi, Fred.
I like many times when we get together. This time we weren't trying to challenge each other and throwing topics at each other and stuff like that. We were talking about basically change management. And before we sat down, I was talking to a former student of mine. He came over for a visit and we were talking shop. My wife decided that I ain't going to go clean out the chicken coop or something else. And instead of two reliability engineers talking shop. And he was talking about, the difficulty of change management, especially with folks that are kind of really set in their ways and the system is, there's no consequence to not meeting deadlines or creating a good product or getting yield up or whatever it is. And that's frustrating. And I think we kind of got to the point where it was, well, they're just not listening. It's like, okay, that sounds like a title and you'd want to make a t-shirt. So
I do.
And it's not unique to just reliability engineering. I think you know that.
Agreed. Yeah.
It goes back to think of the behavior in even grade school. In most schools, there's desks and you come in and you sit down. And unless the teacher has a seating assignment for some reason, whatever desk, even in college, whatever chair or desk you pick at random the first day, and it may be you like to be up front, you might want to be in back, wherever your preferences are, you get a seat. And nobody puts your name on it. Nobody puts a barrier around it that only you can get to it. But it ends up being your seat the whole semester, the whole school year sometimes.
Yes.
Right? Where's that come from? Why do we do that?
It's a great question. It's almost like a first impression type thing. Like it's just decided.
Right. Yeah. It's not voted on. It's not formalized. It's not like a big lottery. Nobody's playing music and there's only one chair too short. Otherwise you have to stand up the whole time. There's none of that. It's just something we do. And going to a church, you sit at the same place generally. It's restaurants, you have a favorite type of chair, or coffee shop, you wait till that chair that you like is open and you go sit there. We do it all the time. And it's habit, it's comfortable, it's familiar, all those kinds of things. To really screw up a group is every time, if you have a standing meeting and you're there every month and whoever's leading the chair sits at the head of the table, get there a little bit early and go sit there instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All hell will break loose.
Yeah. You're breaking the pattern.
Right. And you can do that in a classroom. I would do that in high school just for fun. I just pick a different chair. And they're like, you're in my chair. Really? Your name on it? and it would cause a ripple effect, but we like to not have to make decisions is kind of what I've learned over the years of this process is that in some of this background and information I have, it was in the Army, is in school I went to, was how do you change somebody's behavior, which is really, really hard to do, right? And
there are millions of books on it. Yes,
there are.
Because it's very difficult. Yeah.
It is very difficult. But a lot of what we do in reliability engineering is influence. We're going to, we need the data so that we can track patterns and set priorities and are we making progress or not, or we're doing the wrong thing. What can we learn from, say failures in a prototype? It's gold. A lot of organizations don't want to talk about failures because that's an admission of defeat. And they're like, I think you've reframed that wrong. And that's a different t-shirt. But the idea is,
see, now you're getting on board.
Yeah, I think you already recorded
try as you might, you can't resist this movement, Fred.
I know, I want final sign off on the artwork though.
That's fine.
But the idea is that we in general as people are creatures of habit, and if it's a decision we don't need to make, we're not going to make it. And when you can say, hey, there's a better way, the barriers go up right away. That, well, what's wrong? You're saying what I'm doing now is wrong. They might not think that consciously, right? Yet that's one of the barriers that goes up. It says, and who are you to tell me what to do? There's another barrier. Just where do they think they are in the pecking order versus everybody else? There's dozens of reasons why somebody says, oh, you know, we really should turn right up here. And they don't. They might actually know a better way and just don't have time to tell you about it. In others is, well, we always turn right here, you know, and everything in between. So the part of, and Carl and I wrote about it and talked about it at length. How do you actually do this? How do you convince somebody else to do something different? And that we were talking about it in the context of a reliability plan. Right? But it almost always comes down to, and you can't use a t-shirt on this one because I didn't make it up, is what's in it for them? You know, what's in it for me? The WIFM. And if the, say the technician is, or I think it was Alex mentioned that, you know, they're getting all these failures and they just anecdotally know that it's just, they always have all these failures on this particular part of it. And they just keep seeing it. And I actually ran into a completely different story than Alex's, or what you were talking about earlier, is I ran into a repair lab that it was an incentive of theirs not to report the enough details that it could get fixed because they got paid to fix things. They happy to see the same thing show up because it was easy and quick and they could charge a good amount for it. Their profit margin was great. So they didn't bother reporting any of that stuff. It was in their own benefit. So almost all the time, it's where's the money? What's in it for them? If they're looking at, if I didn't have failures to repair and fix, what would I do all day? You know, do you need a tech to do repairs if there's no repairs to do? It's not an unreasonable thought, especially with all the layoffs going around these days. Right? Others are, well, I know what I'm doing, and if you want me to do something else, then I'm not comfortable with that. And that might not be a conscious thing, but it may be part of the motivation. So it might be, let's record these and look for patterns and trends and set priorities and actually fix things, may go against what's in it for them. And it may actually be an unconscious assessment of that. Right. You could ask somebody, why don't you write this down? And they'll give you 47 reasons why. It was, well, we never look at it. We never do it. Nothing ever happens with it. You know, we got too many. They're all unique. We keep changing the design. On and on and on and on. They're all just excuses to shield what's actually happening is they don't want to change. Right. And you could have a boss saying this is a high priority. But if there's no consequence, last week was something else was a high priority. And the week before that was something else was a high priority. You know, I'll just do the ones I like. So what do you do? What can you do? What are the options you have available? Making t-shirts is not one of them, by the way.
I don't know. I think t-shirts go a long way.
Well, we'll have to try.
As much as I don't, I think there's... You know, it's funny because I have always been against t-shirts, actually. So this is kind of just not because of what they stand. It's just more stuff. Like I just don't want to have more stuff. But, you know, I have seen a sense of camaraderie happen when you do get a thing that is, you know, that says something that you believe in, or it's, you know, and you're all wearing it. But anyways, making t-shirts is you know, aside.
It could work if that's part of the culture, that that's recognized and a reward. Just don't send it to the warehouse in Belgium, right, yes, because they're going to go, why are you sending us underwear?
Yes.
We'd never wear this outside the house, you know, or without a shirt over it. Anything.
Right.
That's
right.
A true story.
Styles are very different in different parts of the world.
Yes. They are very different. Yeah. And, but one way I saw change happen, it was when I was at Raychem, it was a long time ago, and the CEO had, I don't know, a dozen divisions, and we're all within walking distance of each other. I think one of them was a half mile away from somebody else, but most of them were in the same building, essentially, same complex. And we're doing similar things, but we would not cross the line and go ask somebody else in the other division, well, I'm having this problem. What should we do? Because they can't possibly know what we're doing because our product's different and it's unique and they don't know what we know and all kinds of things. So the CEO created an award called the Not Invented Here Award, the NIH Award. Mm-hmm. And it was a polymer of some sort, little desk plaque thing with, you know, not invented here and who was involved in the date and stuff. But it also came with $1,000, which was really cool. Mm. And the rules were somebody has to steal an idea from another group and implement it. And the person that enables that being stolen or sent to the other group also gets the award. So it has to be two players to get the award. You have to consciously get an idea or a process or a tool or something from another division to solve a problem in your own division. And both partners get the award. And my tech, you know, is the same daycare that is tech in another group that had a similar setup to what we did. He said, you know, we're having this problem where they're dropping off their kids one day. And he goes, oh, we solved that. We did this with this tool. And he told me, my tech told me about it. And I says, well, why don't you just drive over there and pick up that? It was an auger basically for an extruder. Go pick up, see if we can borrow one for the afternoon. Let's see if it works. Because we had the exact same extruder equipment. So it would fit in our equipment. And he goes, okay. And so I went and got the materials ready and our team ready to do it. He brought it in, stuck it in the machine. We ran a batch through it. Took it out, cleaned it up. He drove it back. And the next day we found out that it solved the problem we were trying to solve. And so I submitted them both for the Not-Invented Award. He bought me lunch. He took me to a taqueria and got me a bagel or a burrito. That was my reward for it. But it allowed the barrier to be breached because there was this incentive to do it. So that was one of crossing boundaries, but there was an award, a reward for it. It was recognized. So like you were talking earlier that the boss's boss is saying, this is very urgent. This is very important. Well, to who? And what's behind that? You know, all right. Mm. I want 10% of your budget on this. Show me it in the books on Friday. That's a whole lot different than saying, do you understand that this is important? Mm-hmm. And especially if that's something that is repeated on 15 different things. And you know what it's like in a development team. They got to be sustainable and ecological and repairable and manufacturable and every ility you can think of. And they're all important. Mm-hmm. So unless it's really clear, this is, you know, a must-do thing and there's consequences, or better, there's a benefit to doing it, then it's an easier, not sell, but the people you're trying to influence can say, oh, if I do this, this good thing happens to me. I have less repairs later to worry about. I can meet deadlines and I get, you know, an incentive to get promoted. I, you know, there's all these different motivations, some intrinsic, some extrinsic, but our job, because we're influencers, not in the TikTok kind of way,
God forbid. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Maybe that's our next career path. We're going to write this up on TikTok. It's going to go viral. Everybody will be doing reliability for a week. And it'll go away. But the idea is that there's a lot of stuff going on. There's all kinds of forces at play along with what's important to the individual. And so if you really want somebody to change, it's really a combination of trust. They trust what you're saying is going to be useful and work and be beneficial to whatever their priorities are. And two is that you are able to couch it in a way that they can sort out that it's in their own interest to do it. Even better if they believe it's their idea.
Mm-hmm. Inception. Right? Yes.
Well, I
perform,
put it that
perform
way.
Inception, make it think it's their own idea. Yes.
Well, who is it? Socrates, the Socratic method of teaching. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is basically
ask a lot of questions.
It's not just ask a lot of questions. It's ask the right path of questions so that somebody can put the dots together and go, aha, that's why I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yeah, there's tons of books out there, there's all kinds of stuff on it. And it's one of those things that's just not taught in engineering schools, is how to talk to other people, how to listen to other people. And mm-hmm. a big part of that is, well, what I have found has worked when I run into roadblocks is, and it was one guy in particular, his shoulders would slump when I'd show up at his cubicle door. And he was, oh, you know, kind of thing. Well, I'm glad to see you too, Ed. And he's like, oh, you only bring me problems. Well, yeah, that's true, because you're the one that can solve them. And I'm all chipper and stuff. And it just doesn't work. You got to match the tone. You know, if somebody's excited, you be excited. Otherwise, they can't hear you. But that's a whole different thing. But the idea is that I said, well, yeah, I bring you a lot of problems, but you're the guy that has to solve these things because of what we're working on and stuff. And he goes, yeah, I understand that, but I got enough problems already. And so I said, well, is there anything I can help you with? And he goes, yeah. And this was when I was working at HP and I was part of the manufacturing team and I was working as a liaison back to the development team. And basically I said, no, you can't build that. It's not allowed, or we can't assemble that, or vice versa. It was like, we would say you have to do it this way because that's where equipment is set up, where this vendor is set up or whatever. So one of the side jobs we had was to create the prototypes during the development process because we had our own line in the shop. And he goes, I think I told you the story before. He said, what I really want is that when I hit save on the design, you walk in immediately with the circuit board assembled so that I can continue my work, because between save and when I get the circuit board 7 days later, I'm doing housekeeping. I really can't make decisions because I haven't evaluated the actual board to see if these designs and circuits and models are correct or not. Oh, okay. Completely outside my scope. First thing I did, didn't ask permission. Didn't ask my boss that I'm going to go work on this, and laid out every step it took to go from, hey, we want to build a prototype circuit board, to it actually showing up. And it was, you know, not a simple process. Corporate work at its best.
Yeah.
and we found, to make a long story short, we found a step where a procurement person in the process would not buy the last, would only buy long lead time parts ahead of time. And they were usually locked down into the design pretty early, so it was very low risk. But would not buy a $20 set of capacitors that might not get used, because it was going to be either this capacitor or that capacitor. And he says, I can't buy both, so I wait until you make a decision, and it takes 5 days to get here.
Yeah.
And I said, how about, I said, I was in absolutely no position to tell him what to do, right? This is silly, or anything like that. I had no positional power, no organizational connection, anything, to him. And so I said, all right, let me figure this out. This is a policy that's in place so that we don't buy parts that we end up not using, which makes sense. All right. But how many parts are in this group? And it was like 15, in total cost of like $3,000. And so I went to the program manager and said, if we spend an extra $3,000 and you can get the prototypes back in 2 days instead of 7 days, would that be worth changing the policy directing the procurement organization? And he was like, it's $1 million a day to run this lab. If I get 7 days, I get 5 days back, that's $5 million of productivity. Mm-hmm. Yes. Where do I sign? Write it up, you know? And
yeah.
And then he calls my boss and tells me what a great job I was doing. Of course, my boss knew nothing about it. So I get chewed out by him. But then at the same time, I get a congratulatory letter, pat on the back from the general manager, who's my boss's boss four times or something like that. Mm-hmm. But Ed, at that point, became my biggest advocate. He was like, how can I help you?
Right? Yeah, just saved them so much time. Yeah.
Saved them so much time. And I could prove I could get stuff done that could help them. I actually listened, you know, and not every one of them is going to save $5 million every cycle kind of thing. It was, what can I do to solve a problem for you, to build the trust, the competence, all the other stuff? Is, I know it's, what I'm telling you is something you should do different, right? And that's a non-starter. What is, if you're lucky, you go ask somebody, so what keeps you up at night? What is the biggest pain point? What is the issue that, you know, I've got allocations of resources and time. I can help solve something that's bothering you. And if you're really lucky, it's something that you want them to do different anyway. And I'm glad you mentioned that. Here's an idea. What do you think of this? Instead of saying, oh, make sure you write it all down and analyze and send me a report every week, which is completely different than, you know, if we figure out this nuisance problem that you're having over and over again, and it goes away, would that be a good thing for you? And it's a different ask than write it down and let's figure it out and set priorities. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. You're pointing out to them what would be helpful, basically, that would make their life easier.
Right. And it starts from a point of where they are at. Now it becomes, you got to be pretty nimble sometimes. I was in a room, it was like the staff for this production line was there, and every one of them had a different priority. And so it was reporting out on an accelerated life test for this new product. And one of them was looking at yield in the production line. Well, here's how it solves that problem. The leads are further away and they self-center. So even slight misplacements don't cause a repair cycle on it. Here's the evidence. The next one was, what about cost? And it was lined it up that way. Another one was total lifetime. And we had an argument for that. Another one was, you know, whatever. But it was think through or be quick enough to go, this is, I hear your objection. Here's how it helps or solves, or here's another way to think about it, or here's the evidence. And then there's somebody else is on supply chain. Well, that one part replaces three parts in the old one. So you save $1,000 per line item in your stores, you know, per month or whatever the numbers were. And it's, and when you don't know the data, it says, here's how we'd think it through. Is that make sense? Could you help me fill in the numbers? And the hard part in change management is, even though you're convinced you went through that process, my divorce attorney told me this, says, you've already gone through the process. You're ahead of the game. You got to help them catch up, you know, because you and I could say, oh, you need to do an FMEA and here's what you get out of it, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, a who, a what? What do I have to spend 3 hours in the conference room? What are you talking about? But every person you mention that to is going to have a different set of pushback. And that's where I think a skilled change manager, even though I don't think that's actually a title for anybody, nor should be, because nobody would listen to you. Right?
Can't have a qualifier in your title.
That's right. But it's one of those things where the hardest part about an FMEA program is getting the first five people to show up. And each one will probably have a different rationale or something that triggers them to say, this is useful for me. And more organizations are not top down. And you don't want prisoners there anyway, right? You don't want their boss to say, all right, you five show up, be there. And then they're all just dead bodies in chairs looking at you like, is this done yet?
Mm-hmm.
right? You want them to be engaged, and that's the finesse part. That's understanding each person's set of motivations, what's in it for them. Sometimes it's competitive. Oh, if Sarah's going, I got to be there to make sure I don't miss out on anything. And other times it's, you know, well, if I don't participate, I'll look bad as a team player. They'll never tell you that, right? But yet part of convincing people is understanding those things, is their intrinsic motivations. And there is other people who tell you straight out, I need this to work because I want to get promoted. All right. When I hear that from a manager, especially a senior manager, is like, all right, here's what you need to do to make it happen. Here's the script. Here's the timing. Here's the meeting phrases. Here's the questions to ask. One of my most popular courses years and years ago was 3 questions to ask to make you look like a genius with engineers. It had a sexier title than that, but it was well attended by senior managers because they can't possibly know all of the fields that they're getting involved in. But here's 3 questions you can ask that will set your engineers back on their heels. They have to actually go do their homework to drive the change you want to see happen. If the boss is asking about this and expecting a rational answer, I guess I better go do the work. That kind of stuff. But it was only because somebody coached them. And if you want that to change, here's the script. Here's where you need to do. Here's the presentations. Here's the data that you need to present and so on to reinforce it. So part of it is top down. And then one last thought on it is that another way to institute change is go find, like I worked with Ed, and we just changed stuff. Made things happen. We put in standards for how boards were laid out and marks and indicators on them and all kinds of stuff. We just standardized them. And if we went through quality department, it would have taken 2 years of reviews and approvals and presentations and everything. I mean, like, we don't have time for that. So we just did it. And we went and talked to the other primary board designers and they said, oh yeah, I'm on board with that. That's cool. I don't have to think about it anymore, right? Let's just do that. And so we created our own internal document of how to standardize all this stuff and then gave it to the quality department. This is done. Put it in your books, but don't tell anybody it's there because we're going to ignore it anyway. And if you make any changes to it, we're going to ignore it anyway. And they were all bent out of shape for ISO 9000 and all the other stuff. And like, just go away. You're not adding value. Go away. That would have to be on that t-shirt would have to be on a dark.
Oh, yeah, I don't. I don't know about that one.
Yeah, you know, we have to keep it lighthearted. But anyway, I don't know if this is helping at all or not, or if this is making sense.
No, I think it definitely makes sense. I think it's very inherent to any kind of organization, right? Like any organization that's made up of a number of humans that are trying to do something.
Two.
Yeah, two or more. Two or more.
Although I argue with myself sometimes.
Yeah, where decision-making requires more than one person, I think is, you know, I think everything that you're saying can be very applicable or is very applicable. And I think the key thing is, I'm trying to think about like what's the as I normally do. I think everyone that knows me would understand. It's just like, okay, what's the most efficient way, basically, to get to the answer, right? To get to the action that you want being implemented. And I think this is a big part of that.
Yeah. And sometimes it's just rolling up your sleeves and collecting the data yourself and saying, see, if we automate this, we could do this every day.
If 100%. Yes.
Right. Yeah. But if we do it manually, here's the value of it. This is one of the biggest changes I ever made in my whole career and it took me 2 years to get the data for the final point of it. Dick Moss had in the early 80s found out that the warranty was around 3.5-4% of net revenue in the corporation for all their products. Oh, in the early 80s, around 3.5-4%. And they decided, CEO said, no, we got to fix that. That's a lot of money. And they got it down to about 1%. And over that time period, they saved billions of dollars. In today's dollars, even more. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of all said, okay, that project's done. We don't have to think about that. We got it. We got it in the bag. Everybody's doing it. We've been working on it for years, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course it all disappeared. And so I come on the scene about 5 years later, and it took me 2 years to even find the equivalent numbers. What was our total warranty cost across the corporation? And it wasn't reported in the public, FTC, Federal Trade Commission, reporting of public companies. They didn't require reporting warranty accruals. And so I just went and asked embarrassing questions to every senior manager I could find. How much are we spending on engineering talent to create our products? Oh, it's 7% of our net revenue. Okay, well, how much are we spending on warranty? And they're like, I don't know. You know, it used to be this was really bad. 5 years ago, it was this. Is it still there? And finally, they got tired of that and they assigned me somebody in finance to go track it down. And I got a number and it was back up to 4%. And when the company was much, much larger at that point. So this was billions of dollars of warranty expenses that nobody was managing or tracking or monitoring. Yeah. And we called it the V chart. And I knew it was successful when a handful of senior vice presidents were using it with their name associated with it. They made it up. I'm like, fine with me. And it made a huge change in the company. And but it was, sometimes the change takes a long time and you got to just roll up your sleeves and be a pest or, you know, go down to the shop floor and collect the data yourself. And other times it's, you can convince enough other champions that see the vision, see what you're trying to do and why it's a useful thing for them, their customers, their careers, and you're off and running. And sometimes you ask, so what problems or pain points do you have? And it's exactly what you're proposing, but they never heard you for the last 3 months. So it can vary a lot. And there's no one right way to do it. But, you know, if whatever you're doing is not working, do something else.
Yeah. Change strategy.
Yeah. If you're up to make a change, though. This is not a process to make you change. This is a process to get stuff done.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Well, I love it.
We rambled on this one for a while, didn't we?
It was very good, though. It's very important.
It is important. All right,
it's very helpful.
For a change, we could ask our audience to see what they think of this.
We ask that all the time.
You know what to do. You know?
Yes.
We always look for questions and stuff. And today, some of it was sparked by one of my formal students. I'm pointing at my deck like you could see me. We sat outside, had a cup of coffee and talked shop and sparked a couple of questions. And I think you and I were talking about something similar. So let's hit record. So, but if you'd like to, if you're listening to this and like to spark that yourself, listen to one of the other episodes where you'll hear how to do that. And other than that, I'm not going to summarize it anymore. So thanks, John, for the discussion, or at least listening to me ramble on this stuff. And
no, thank you.
All right. And we'll talk again soon.
It was a great discussion. Awesome.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.